everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. How are you today on this March 18th, 2014? Yeah, it's going to be a sweet half hour this next, the first part of the program. Very, very sweet. And, you know, I mentioned last week, the week before, maybe the week before that, that I was invited to give a talk to about 200 cattle producers about animal agriculture's contribution to climate change. So I've been very focused lately about what's going on with our environment. And it's scary. But when I hear about things that are good for the environment, I get very excited. And that's why I brought my next guest on to the program. So I'm going to bring him on right now. And he's here with me in the studio. Michael Farrell serves as the director of Cornell University's Eline Forest, a maple syrup research and extension field station in Lake Placid, New York. There, he taps approximately 5,000 maples, 600 birch trees, and a couple dozen black walnut and butternut trees every year. He has authored dozens of articles on maple syrup production and forest management and often presents to maple producer and landowner organizations. Michael earned his bachelor's degree in economics from Hamilton College, his master's in forestry from SUNY ESF, and his PhD in natural resources from Cornell University. Thanks for joining me today, Michael.
Thanks for having me on. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, and you also authored a book, which I just got. Thank you very much, and I look forward to reading, The Sugar Maker's Companion, An Integrated Approach to Producing Syrup from Maple, Birch, and Walnut Trees. Okay, so let's talk about syrup.
Okay.
And sap and sugar. Okay, so I'm very excited because in my climate change research, I learned lots of horrible things about trees. So we have deforested about half of the planet's trees, and that doesn't bode well for the carbon cycle balance, sucking the CO2 out of the environment and putting oxygen into the environment. We need trees, and we need more of them. So I get excited when I hear about people that can actually make some money off of trees while they're doing something good for the environment. And we all love syrup. We all love sweet things. So let's first talk about syrup or sap and where it comes from, how the tree makes it, and just I'm turning it over to you.
Sure, yeah, and that is one of the great things about maple syrup production or tapping birch or walnut trees, as well as that you can tap these trees year after year. They continue to grow, sequester that carbon, produce the oxygen, all the benefits of trees, and rather than having to cut them down in order to get value out of them, you keep them living and tap them every spring. And that sap that flows through these trees in the springtime is what we collect for that short period of time. Basically now, March and April is the prime time for the sap collection. And with maple syrup production, we just collect the sap and basically boil it down until we get syrup.
Okay, sap. What is it? What is it doing inside the tree?
So just like, you know, a kind of an analogy that it's not the perfect analogy, but something that people can relate to is just like we have blood, trees have sap. And that sap carries the sugars, the food for the tree, and minerals and nutrients and all this good stuff in the sap, all the stuff that the tree needs for its own growth and health and survival, that's what's in the sap. And we are fortunate enough to be able to have these trees with this sap and to be able to collect a small amount of it. We're only taking a small percentage of the sap out of the tree. Just like when we go to give blood, we're only giving maybe a pint of blood. We don't take more than, we think the estimate is about 5% of the sap out of a tree.
Now, that sap, does it exist all year long? Is it in the tree all year long?
Well, the trees do have a type of sap in them all year, but the xylem sap that flows in the spring is only during that time that we can collect it.
So the xylem sap, is it more liquidy, watery?
Or? It's all water. Remember, it's almost, sap is almost all water. But this is what's available that we can easily collect. And it's that time of the year that it's running in the trees because of the weather conditions as well. It's the freezing and thawing of that sap in maple trees during basically February, March, and April when you have the right weather conditions that causes the sap to come out of any type of wound in the tree, such as a tap hole.
Okay, you brought up something important, freezing and thawing. Now, this year it's been pretty cold, but last year was a pretty warm winter, if I remember. And there, we were all being told that maple syrup was going to be hard to find, and it was going to be abundant, it was going to be expensive. It's already expensive, but it was going to be worse. So what happens there?
It was actually 2 years ago they had the very warm winter.
Last year,
yeah. And that was extremely warm. But luckily, prices didn't spike because there was a reserve of syrup from the years before that. Quebec supplies 75% of the syrup in the world. And they keep syrup from year to year. They'll have a reserve, the strategic reserve, they call it, so that if you have a bad year based on the weather, you can still supply the markets with syrup that you have collected in previous years, because syrup doesn't go bad as long as you process it and preserve it correctly in the right method. It can last forever,
so we can always have pancakes.
That's the plan. Or all the other things you can do with syrup, so it's not just for pancakes. Right. Okay, now
what was interesting, what I learned today, is that it's just not maple that makes syrup.
The birch and the walnut trees also have this sap running through them in the springtime. The walnut sap runs at the same time as maple. It's based on that freezing and thawing to get the sap to flow in the walnuts. And the birch is after maple and walnuts are done. So when the season is wrapped up, say in mid-April for maple and walnut, then you can tap your birch trees, and they also have a delicious and nutritious sap.
Do you know why we're so focused on maple and we've kind of forgotten about maple and birch?
Walnut and birch.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
walnut
that's
and
okay.
Birch.
Yeah. Well, we never really knew much about walnut. People haven't really ever developed that as a product. It's always been maybe a small niche thing that some people were doing, but it's never taken off the way maple has. And I think one of the main reasons behind that is the fact that you don't get as much sap. With maples, you get a lot of sap, and the sap is sweet. It's 2% sugar on average. The walnut sap is also maybe about 2% sugar, but you don't get as much. So if you're going to just choose one tree to tap, why not the maple? Because you can get more sap with the same amount of work to try to collect it. So maybe that's why maple took off and not walnut. But that doesn't mean you can't do walnut. If you have a lot of walnuts, then... They also make them. You got to try some of that walnut.
Yeah, it was delicious.
Yeah, great stuff. So, or you can combine them together. If you have maples and walnuts, make a maple walnut syrup.
Now, another thing I was fascinated about was what you told us today is how many trees there are out there that are not even being tapped. It's the tip of the iceberg. The tip of the melting iceberg, of course. But what we're tapping to get syrup from.
Yeah, in the U.S. alone, we have about 2 billion potentially tappable maple trees, sugar maple and red maple. Those are the top two species. Sugar maple is the best for sugaring. That's why it's got its name, sugar maple, because you get the most sap and the sweetest sap. But with red maple, you can also tap those. They're actually more abundant in our country than sugar maple. And they might not produce quite as much sap, and the sugar content might be a little lower, but they're perfectly good for sugaring. So we have 2 billion of these trees. We're using far less than 1% of them right now. And so we have this incredible opportunity to tap more of them, to produce more maple syrup, and all the other great things you can make from maple, and consume more of that. You know, our consumption, our per capita consumption of pure maple in the U.S. is about 3 ounces per person per year.
Oh, that's nothing.
Exactly. Right. And most of that comes from Canada.
Oh, and you know why it's only 3 ounces?
Because
most people are having Aunt Jemima and log cabin syrup, which is full of high fructose corn syrup.
Exactly.
And tastes like crap.
But that's because it's so much cheaper.
So much cheaper.
Right. And so when we know that we're consuming too much of that we don't need as much high fructose corn syrup in our diet as we're getting. I don't think anybody's going to argue otherwise. Even though pure maple is more expensive, I think that's a good thing because we have so much high fructose corn syrup in our diet because it's so cheap. And when food is cheap, it's put in a lot of things and it's added to so many different foods. If we use pure maple like we used to, you don't have as much sugar, and it's a healthier sugar, and it's a local one, and less environmental impact. So there's lots of good reasons why we should be producing and consuming more pure maple.
That definitely fits into my agenda because I would like people to get back to being a little more sophisticated about what they're eating, care about where their food comes from, and have a cleaner palate where they can really discern different flavors and tell the difference between high fructose corn syrup, quote, maple syrup, and real maple syrup. But some people can't even tell.
Exactly. And I'm sure your listeners probably have a more refined palate and would be able to.
Of course they do.
Yes. but the average American doesn't. And the average American is just looking for the maybe the cheapest topping for their pancakes.
Right. And more. Big volume and inexpensive. And it's sad because it's affecting our health. It's affecting the environment. And, you know, I talk about treats. And I haven't talked about treats in a while, and I don't think so. It's a good time to talk about treats. Treats should be a treat. What does that mean? Not all the time. So it's special. And then when you have it, it's just sheer bliss. Instead of always consuming all this sweet stuff that's so bad for us, you don't have that contrast.
I think maple sap is that spring treat, right? So we had that historically in our culture. You know, you think about people. For hundreds of years ago, were just trying to get through the winter, right? They were not having sugary, soded beverages all the time. I mean, it was bare bone survival through the winter, and there was fairly bland food, and they were just making it through. And at the end of winter, let's say you're sick of eating the same bland food you've had all winter. It's finally nice and warm out. The sap is running in the maple trees. You're drinking that maple sap.
It's delicious. I love it.
And it's sweet, and it's a spring treat.
Well, I had the birch sap today.
And that's also, you had the birch syrup today.
The birch syrup. You mean the one that was like water?
The maple sap, the one that we drank like water, that was maple sap.
Okay. Yeah. And the vertical water was
that's maple sap.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. It was
both
from
maple trees, but you can also drink the birch sap, and the birch sap will run later. It's not quite, there's not nearly as much sugar in it. It's not as much of a treat. For instance,
no, but most people don't drink water, and they don't drink enough water, and they should. Okay,
yeah.
And this drinking sap, which I never thought about doing, I'm very excited about drinking sap, folks.
Yes,
it's mostly water.
Yep,
it's got some trace minerals in it. It's
sure.
not. It's not really where you want to go to for your minerals. You want to get your minerals from your dark leafy green vegetables and some other foods, but you know they're still nice to have them there. Can't
Definitely.
Hurt. And it's just a nice subtle flavor because when I drink water, I always like to squeeze something into it, just give it a little kick.
Sure.
And this is just naturally flavored, just the lightest subtle hint of sweetness.
Yes, definitely.
It was a beautiful drink.
Yeah, I'm glad that there's lots of companies now getting into bottling and making it available for lots of people. You know, one time we were doing a taste test, and I heard somebody say, well, I don't even like water, but I love maple water. So if we can get more people to drink water, which is basically is,
right.
You know, then we're all going to be much better off.
It's a win-win. Now, what about other trees? Do almond trees make sap?
I've never tapped an almond tree, so I don't know. But it's potential.
I'm just wondering because, I'm wondering how the water supply connects to the sap in the tree. Because on the West Coast, they're having this serious drought.
Sure, yeah.
And how does that affect drought?
I mean,
how does that affect sap?
Yeah, well, soil moisture is a limiting factor in the amount of sap you get out of the trees. So we know that from maple research here in the Northeast. So if you're having a significant drought in California, on the West Coast, wherever, that's going to affect the health of the trees and it's going to limit the amount of sap in the trees and therefore the health of the tree. And
are these trees irrigated or they're just naturally in good
water? Our forest that we collect, you know, maple sap, it comes from wild forests, which are not irrigated. It's just whatever Mother Nature provides. So all the almond trees in the West, though, of course, are irrigated. And
okay, now the sap in the tree, in the springtime, it's really flowing. And then what happens? Does it dry out? It goes into leaves? It goes back into the roots? Where does it go?
Well, it's constantly present in the tree throughout the year, but not in a form that we can easily get into. Okay, so it's only for maple sap. It's only that limited time in late winter, early spring that it's present in the xylem, and we can drill into the tree and easily get it.
Okay, we talked about this earlier, and I want to talk about it now with everybody listening.
Sure.
And I had heard some things about, since I'm a vegan, how some things in the process of making maple syrup may or may not be vegan. And I remember hearing that some people use butter and some people use some sort of pork fat. And I never really understood what it was used for.
Okay.
And you can tell us.
Yes. When you're boiling the sap, it foams up a lot. And your pans on your evaporator where you're boiling it are only so tall. And you could get so much foam that it starts to boil over. And it comes out of your pans, out of your evaporator pans. And so you put in a little bit of defoamer in order to keep the foam down, to keep your boiling sap within the pans. Traditionally, people who aren't vegan would mm-hmm. put some type of pork fat or bacon or suspend something above the evaporator so that if the boiling sap got up to a certain level, it would hit that piece of bacon or pork fat, and the fat molecules in that would get into the foam, and it knocks the foam down.
It's a defoaming agent. It would melt and drip into the foam, I guess.
Exactly, yeah. So that is hardly ever used anymore.
That's good.
Yeah, so some people are still doing it. I mean, there's lots of backyard sugar makers who aren't vegans and do it that kind of way, or might put some butter or cream in. Because any type of fat molecule will knock the foam down. Most people are using a commercially available defoamer that's just a chemically synthesized product that acts like a fat molecule. You use a tiny bit of it, it doesn't even show up in the syrup, and it works very well. So that's what people pretty much use today. That's the standard. Unless you're an organically certified maple syrup producer, pretty much the only difference, noticeable difference in producing organic maple syrup versus conventional maple syrup, is the type of defoamer you can use. And the organic producers have to use an organic safflower oil or canola oil or sunflower or some type of vegetable oil to keep the foam down.
Now, who knew that? I didn't know that. That's really interesting information. Now, that leads into the next question, which is organic maple syrup versus conventional. And I'm getting the feeling like most conventional growers don't use herbicides and pesticides or very little.
Yeah, exactly.
What's the story there?
Most maple syrup comes from wild forests, never treated with any type of pesticide or herbicide or fertilizer. It's just the woods. And there's nothing more organic than just our natural wild mm-hmm. forests. And this is just the pure sap flowing through those trees, never anywhere even close to pesticides or herbicides or fertilizers.
So if we wanted to spend $16 or $17 on a 32-ounce jug of maple syrup conventional instead of $18 or $19 on organic, it would be okay.
I think that'd be fine, yeah. The main difference is that it's pure maple and not the artificial, because the biggest difference is pure maple syrup versus the Aunt Jemima and all the artificial. The difference between conventionally produced, I wouldn't even say conventionally produced, I'd just say not certified and certified. There's just a lot of maple producers who, you know, for whatever reason, they don't want to go through the paperwork of getting certified mm-hmm. and the cost of doing that.
Right.
But it doesn't mean their syrup isn't really organic.
What about grade A and grade B?
So those are different grades of the syrup based on the color and the flavor of the syrup. The color and the flavor of the syrup will change a lot during the course of the season. You might start out making the light syrup with a more delicate, mild flavor. And by the end of the season, you're making darker syrups with a stronger flavor. Mm. And that's the grade B. So there's three grades of grade A, the light amber, medium amber, and dark amber. And then one grade of
I always like the more intense flavors, but somehow I feel like because it's called grade B or grade C, it's not as good quality.
Well, and that's why we're actually changing the international grading system. I'm glad
good.
You asked about that. So starting, it's already started in Vermont this year. In New York, it's going to start next year.
Yeah, that was a bad marketing concept, right?
Well, you know, I think the maple producers might not have been as forward-looking when they developed that because at the time, when this was all developed, maple producers pride themselves on making the lightest syrup. That's what mm-hmm. maple producers tend to like, is the lightest. And it used to be very difficult to make the light syrup. You had to really be a good sugar maker and do everything right to make it light syrup. Now with technological advances and sap collection and processing, almost anybody can make light syrup. And there's a lot more light syrup being made. And when we do consumer taste tests, we realize that people like the dark stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So why would we be calling something grade B just because it's the darker syrup? Because there's a lot of people who know that grade B is more flavorful, and that's what they look out for. But nobody goes to the store looking for grade B eggs. So why would you go for grade B maple syrup if you don't really know? And so everything's going to be grade A from now on.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. We got to taste some today, and I'm looking forward to that future technology where we're able to taste and smell over the air some kind of virtual scratch and sniff or something, but we don't have that right now. So you're just going to have to listen to the descriptions. But I got to try some today, and I was I was in the minority. I liked what no one else liked the best, and that was the birch syrup.
Yes,
which I wrote here. It had like a molasses flavor and color and consistency, but there was it was a little fruity. It was a little tart, and I just liked the lingering aftertaste flavor. I kind of went nuts over it.
Sure, yeah, it's great stuff, and you know, most people aren't used to birch syrup. It's way different than maple syrup, as you noticed, and has definitely those unique qualities. I often hear people describe it as fruity molasses. Actually, when we're boiling the sap, when we're making the syrup, people who come in our sugar house think we're making raspberry jam.
Ooh.
Because it smells just like raspberries when in our sugar house. It's that fruity kind of aroma and flavor to it. And, you know, it's great as an ingredient for cooking. So I think there's great opportunities for people to experiment with different recipes with birch syrup. It always should be used as a cooking ingredient. It's not a pancake topping. And, you know, those...
Well, I have to confess that I rarely use maple syrup on my pancakes. I'm more of a... I don't use a lot of sugar in things, and I tend to just take blueberries or strawberries and make like a compote out of them. That's what I put on my pancakes.
Sure.
But that's me.
Well, I should say I don't even eat pancakes hardly at all either.
But I do like, we eat a lot of pancakes, vegan pancakes, gluten-free.
Okay.
And there's wonderful pancake recipes on my responsibleeatingandliving.com website. So if you're getting a hankering for pancakes right now, we've got so many great pancake recipes, and you might even try them. I've got chestnut flour pancakes and cornmeal flour pancakes and buckwheat flour pancakes.
I will have to try
and
that.
And they're all excellent. And I bet they'd be even better with some of these syrups. But the walnut syrup, I love walnuts. And there was just, you know, like a hint of that walnutty flavor in the syrup. Fabulous.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. We just have a few minutes left. I wondered what other trees can be tapped for this syrup. I was thinking are tropical trees.
Yeah, the only one in the tropics that I know of, and of course I focus here on the Northeast, but I have heard of people tapping palm trees. They climb up to the top of the palm trees and cut off the inflorescence, and a sap comes out which is very high in sugar. I think it's about 10 to 12% sugar. And because it's in the tropics, it'll ferment rapidly. So they either turn it into a wine or they feed it directly to pigs.
Right.
So I'm sure you're not too into that. But
I'm not sure where that all fits in sustainable palm scenario, which
I'm not
is
sure either.
A big hot button these days.
Yeah, but you know, our method is a lot more sustainable. We're just drilling a small hole in the trunk of the tree, and the tree continues to grow year after year. So.
Well, what I love, coconut water is becoming very popular here in the States, and I really like to promote things that are locally sourced and locally grown. So the fact that we can have birch water or maple water, which is somewhat similar to coconut water,
sure.
And we grow it right here in the the East Coast.
And you know, we've done taste tests, and people prefer the maple water over coconut water very much so. It's got a much more pleasant taste to it. It doesn't have quite as many minerals in it, but there's a lot of minerals in both of them.
Right.
And there's lower sugar in the maple water. Coconut water has usually 2 to 3 times the amount of calories from sugar as maple water does. So,
now, I don't know how often this is happening, and it's probably not something you're as excited about as I am, but you were talking about how there have been some dairy trucks that have been repurposed to transport maple water?
Well, not really repurposed, but just during that time of the year.
Oh,
so they can either
them.
Yeah, so they can okay. They're usually hauling milk 350 days out of the year, and for 2 weeks they might be hauling maple
sap. Right, cuz I'm always looking for alternative careers for all of those dairy farmers.
Oh, okay.
Right. Cuz I would like milk to go away.
Yeah. Well, those milk you know, you should know that in the sugaring industry, we've borrowed a lot of our technology from the dairy farm. And we use a lot of their old stainless steel tanks. Their old milk tanks are great for collecting maple sap.
I have no problem with that, repurposing all that stuff for better purposes, in my opinion. Okay, so we have like 5 minutes left, and I'm just checking my notes for some things that I thought were interesting that I don't want to forget. Oh, so we're, you know, here in the United States, we somehow we became very limited with what we were eating, and, you know, Big Ag has been responsible for that because they like to make things efficient and keep things easier and easier to make. So we're getting less and less variety of foods, and that's a shame because there's just so many wonderful foods out there that we should all be experiencing, and some of them are local in our own neighborhood that we don't get to experience anymore. But you were talking about how birch is consumed, this birch water is consumed in many places around the world.
Sure. It's a traditional drink in throughout many places in Europe and Scandinavia and Russia and Japan, Korea, China. There's a lot of birch trees in those parts of the world, in the temperate and boreal forest. They don't have as many maples as we do. There might be some, but their forests are much more dominated by birch. And so they collect the birch sap and drink it as a spring tonic. Very little of it gets made into syrup. I actually just met a young lady from the Ukraine this past weekend who told me she drank birch sap her entire life and never knew that anybody processed it into syrup. She came here to the U.S. and she had never seen birch syrup, but she drank birch sap every year. And that she said everybody does that over there.
I thought I wrote it down, and I can't find it, but there's a fast starting today.
Yes,
a
right.
week-long
yeah.
fast with maple water. Now, I know a lot of my listeners are into all kinds of funky fasts.
Yeah, well, this is the time of the year. You know, a lot of people know about the Master Cleanse diet.
Yeah, right.
Where you're basically taking maple syrup.
Lemon
juice, cayenne pepper, making a tea out of that.
Right.
Okay, and you're almost trying to recreate a maple water, a maple sap fast.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're into that kind of stuff, rather than doing it the Master Cleanse, you might just want to just drink the sap. And, yeah, I know a guy in Michigan who he found out about this. He started drinking sap. He says he feels great. I'm sure he does. I mean, this is one of the times of the year I feel the best is when I'm drinking the sap out of the trees. And there's many days I'm not a big faster, but sometimes I'm just working so much during the day, I don't have time to eat, and I'm just drinking sap all day, and I feel great. So it keeps the energy up, and I highly recommend it.
Yeah, I love the idea. Okay, we're out of time. So thank you so much for joining me, Michael.
Well, thanks for having me on.
I really enjoyed tasting all these things. I'm going to look forward to some of these products, finding them more frequently.
Definitely.
Out and about.
Yeah, well, we'll be doing as much as we can.
Okay. You're listening to It's All About Food. We're going to take a quick break. I'm Karen Hartglass. Go visit ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com while we're on the break if you have a minute, and check out my pancake recipes. We'll be right back. Hello, everybody. We're back. I'm Karen Hartglass, and this is It's All About Food. And I'm just very, very excited about this right now. So I went to a little university in a town that time forgot, called Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. And that was Bucknell University. And it was a long time ago. But the school really hasn't changed much. They've added a few buildings here and there. And last year when it was just a few months ago, I think, I got my alumni news. And I learned about Lisa McComsey, who came out with a book called The Vegan Cheat Sheet. And I went, what? What? Another vegan went to Bucknell? So I had to bring her on the program. And she's here with me in the studio, along with her co-author, Amy Kramer. And let me just give you a little introduction. I had it in front of me, and I don't have it anymore because I had some computer problems. But I'm going to read from the book just briefly. Amy is a vegan chef, coach, instructor, and entrepreneur. And actually, I'm going to have you go to my website and read more about them because I just want to talk to them. And Lisa is a writer, marketing consultant, and public speaker. And they both co-authored The Vegan Cheat Sheet. So welcome to It's All About Food, Lisa and Amy.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Okay, great. So first, when I was at Bucknell, we had a vegetarian meal plan. We had this guy, Hank Ross. Was he there when you were there?
Yes, he was.
And he instituted the vegetarian meal plan. And I was sad to learn many years later that they didn't have one anymore. Yeah, it's over. But I guess maybe they just offer a wide variety of food so you can just pick and choose. But it was a long time ago. And it's always very exciting to find out that there are other people that have taken similar journeys as you have. And I found Lisa. So, hi, Lisa.
Hi, Karen.
I just met her, too.
We passed each other on the lawn at Bucknell at some point, I'm sure.
I guess so. Right. I graduated in 80.
I was 81.
81. Mm-hmm. Look at that. And, oh, my goodness. Well, destiny wanted us to get together at some point. I remember, this wasn't vegan, but one of the first dishes I ever made in my freshman dorm room in Roberts.
Mm-hmm.
They
that
had a little
my
kitchen.
Freshman dorm room.
We decided we wanted to cook, and I made a vegetarian lasagna, and we collected as many saltine crackers as we could get from the cafeteria for our breading. And it was pretty good. But I think we're all better cooks now. Okay, so briefly, Lisa, tell me your story about how you learned to love plants, and then Amy, you can tell me yours.
Great.
I was not a vegetarian back in Bucknell days. I was very much an omnivore, although I believe it was during my college years I decided to give up meat. I felt that red meat was not a healthy choice. But for the next several decades, I enjoyed poultry and fish.
The feathered
and
vegetable
dairy.
And the scaly vegetable.
Yes. And lots and lots of dairy. I loved all those foods. I had ice cream sundaes and pizza and yogurt and all kinds of great things all the time. I was very much into exercise, and I think I felt I could eat whatever I wanted mm-hmm. without really gaining weight. And my motivation for going vegan was twofold. One was my family was about to embark on a Get Fit competition. And we all put money into a pot, made weight loss and fitness goals, and the person who succeeded met his or her goals at the end, won this big pot of money. I was very motivated by the pot of money. And at the same time, I talked to Amy, with whom I've been friends for many years. We were colleagues at People magazine many years ago. And she and her husband had gone vegan. And this coincided perfectly with my family fit competition. I thought, I'll try going vegan for 1 month, thinking I would hate it. I could only survive on carrot sticks and tofu for about 4 weeks. After that, it was back to the usual fare. And once I got over the overwhelm factor of what am I going to eat and how am I going to make these things, once I got used to it, I absolutely fell in love with it. I felt like a whole new world opened up to me. New foods, new flavors. Right. I discovered new recipes. I just became impassioned with this way of eating. And that was 5 years ago.
Great. So many of us have that experience. And the trick is, how do we get people to just make that leap? And, you know, there are all the different kinds of incentives, the 30-day, the 21-day, mm-hmm. the 60-day, the, you know, 20, whatever. Just try it. And you start
yes.
to feel good.
Yes. You and know, my motivation was for health reasons. I read The China Study and Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease. Those two books single-handedly convinced mm-hmm. me that I needed to eliminate animal right. products from my diet.
Okay, Amy, how about you?
Okay, my story began, my husband was on cholesterol meds as long as I remember. Mm-hmm. I had met him in college, and probably by the time he was in his 20s, he had hereditarily high cholesterol. And whenever we would go out to a restaurant, he would always order the salad with maybe grilled chicken, no dressing. I would order the hamburger, and he really, you know, ate like someone that was really trying to watch their health and watch their, you know, weight. However, he still had hereditarily high cholesterol. So finally, the doctors just had to put him on meds at a very, very young age and said he would always be on statins. And he hated it. He had been on probably for, oh gosh, since he was probably 30. And right now he's 50. So he had been on that for 15 years and just was tired of being on meds and thought there must be a better way. We were lucky enough to be living in Cleveland at the time.
Ah.
I thought it was lucky. Mm-hmm. And my husband grew up and knew the Esselstyn family, the famous Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn, who wrote Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease. So he knew of Dr. Esselstyn's theory that you can actually go off cholesterol meds and reduce your cholesterol naturally to such an extent without medication. And obviously prevent and reverse any heart disease you have and prevent any future. The preventing part was the part that my husband was focused on. So he just went full force into Dr. Esselstyn's program, 100% plant-based, and then began with no added oils whatsoever, which is actually the way we remained. And, within weeks, he started, you know, going down with his doctor's supervision on his cholesterol meds, and now he's been off his cholesterol meds for almost, you know, by 14 years and never looked back.
Wow.
So I did it to really support him. And then I found I loved it. And then I took my passions of cooking and made it into my business, which is cooking, you know, oil-free vegan foods for the consumers.
Well, statins can be really dangerous. They may lower your cholesterol, but they can do a lot of other damage. So it's good that he got off them.
Yeah.
And this thing about something being hereditary, we're learning more and more about genes expressing themselves or not. And they don't have to express themselves if you don't give them the opportunity.
Right.
Yeah. And you know, so many people, they just give up because they say it's hereditary to my family. There's nothing I can do about it. And that's not true.
And that's the same with cancers as well, obviously, as you know, Dr. Campbell's books, which basically was talking about how everyone, you know, people, you know, grew up with exposed to whatever things and toxins and predispositions as they were, but eating these animal proteins can trigger things that never would have been triggered if you don't consume the animal proteins if you have a plant-based diet. And that was my motivation after, you know, I did it for my husband, but really that also resonated tremendously with me. It was just always a lifetime fear.
Right. And you're both into fitness, and you're both feeling physically pretty awesome,
absolutely.
Right?
Yes,
absolutely.
Yes, we are.
Energy level not. It's quite the opposite. I think that as far as the energy level, I think people are concerned that they don't eat enough, and I think that that's ridiculous. That's a fallacy. But also the change in energy level, the feeling that you get after a meal, especially the one I would get, and I think Lisa would get as well when we consume dairy, that exhaustion, that tired, that just wanting to lay down after a meal really just goes away when you don't consume, or at least for us, when you don't consume those animal-based products. And specifically for me, it was dairy.
Yep. Well, I love to hear these stories. And fortunately, I think we're making a dent. Now, you mentioned cancer. I am an ovarian cancer survivor.
Yes.
Somehow I got it. And I have some theories about how it happened to me. But the point is here, it's been 7.5 years and I'm alive and thriving where, you know, unfortunately, most women don't get through it. But one of the things that I was happy to discover, unfortunately, I was with a close relative who has been just diagnosed with advanced ovarian cancer, and I was with her in the hospital talking to her future surgeon, and she was talking about to the nurse about what food she might get, and she said, I'm a vegan, I want vegan food, and there was the nurse didn't even flinch. It was like, yeah, no problem. And I thought, whoa, I mean, 7 years ago that didn't happen, and I'm sure it's not happening everywhere, but it's getting better. People know this word, and I think it's just going to now snowball and just go really fast. I'm hoping.
I just find when I do talks, there are so many misconceptions about what the vegan diet is.
Mm-hmm.
And I get up there and I see eyes glaze over. Oh, here's somebody talking about going vegan. And by the end of the talk, I've sold 10 or 20 books. Mm-hmm. People cannot believe the things they can eat. It's not a deprivation diet. It's, like I said, full of flavors and textures, and you can eat pancakes and pizza
pancakes.
And muffins. And I heard the pancake thing, and I want to find your pancake recipes. And we have pancake recipes in our book as well, but it's a rich, rich diet.
Yes, it's a rich diet, and we all end up looking fabulous relative to our peers who aren't looking as fabulous, because it could be a vanity diet, too.
Absolutely.
You know, I got into it because I didn't want to kill animals, but there's a piece of it where, you know, I want to look as good as I can.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I think I'm looking pretty good.
You do look fabulous.
Absolutely. And I can't even, yes.
You can't even see me. I'm looking at, let's just breeze through some of the recipes in here. So this is a nice book, The Vegan Cheat Sheet. It's got some basic information about going vegan and the foods you'll eat and not eat, and the vitamins and nutritional components of different foods, and then some recipes. I'm looking at spinach calzones. And I bring
easiest
that
easiest thing ever.
Yeah, well, you know, we don't see calzones very often anywhere around, and so I'm always excited when I see calzone recipes or Stromboli recipes, because they're.
Yeah, I guess growing up in New York, I loved calzones, and
yeah.
I was really looking for a way to feed the family. And I know my kids. I think if they control what's inside the calzone, they're a lot more likely to eat it. If I decide what's going in, then they'll bark at it. But if they say, Mom, put, you know, some peppers, or put some, you know, don't put any peppers, or just put some spinach inside mine, or put some broccoli. And it's just as easy to make 4 custom calzones and throw whatever I want in than it would be to make them all the same.
Mm-hmm.
And I mark each one on top, maybe with a little piece of broccoli or a little piece of tomato when I bake them. Everyone gets their individual. And I find that to be a quick, easy, even a dinner to go
when
everyone's in a rush.
It's a winner. And I'm surprised that I don't see more of these, but it's comforting. It's that comfort kind of food packaged in a nice bread, all tucked in, cozy and gooey and very good. Very good. And so most of the recipes in here are simple. There's the mujadara. Now, I'm a big fan of lentils, and usually when you get that in a restaurant, it's like oil and mujadara.
Mm-hmm. You know what? I think the oil, you know, I have to be honest. Lisa and I have, discovered that I think you'd be hard-pressed to taste any of the recipes in the book and really realize that there isn't oil. People feel that you need oil to start everything in your kitchen. Every time you fry something, you need oil. And I just gave it up as simple as not doing it. And I would start, I'd pick a really nice, heavy, dark pan. Everyone figures out whatever their favorite pan is at home to use. And you start your onions dry. And then whenever your onions start to stick a little or maybe start to brown, add a little water, and just a teeny bit of water, maybe a quarter cup. It deglazes your pan right away. And then it's cooking in its own natural sugars and juices. And you enhance the flavor of the vegetable. So I think that the elimination of oils or anything processed, for that matter, is a pretty quick and easy one, and I don't think it's noticeable in the flavor of the foods.
Now, you've probably gotten the response, what? No oil?
Oh, here we go.
I hear
oil?
That all. People fight me on it. I'm not even the chef. Amy's the chef, but I find myself defending it because I've tried it, and it's so easy, and it doesn't change the flavor. As Amy said, it really enhances it in some way because of the way it's cooked and caramelized.
Yeah, I agree. I'm sometimes hesitant to bring up the oil part when I'm just trying to get people interested in the diet and get them off of animal. And then, you know, I throw in, by the way, I don't use oil in my recipes. And then that's what they focus on, and they really get crazy.
Mm-hmm.
What is it in our makeup? Yes.
Yeah, if you follow a recipe, I would think it's just the old-fashioned way. They saw their mothers starting every single pan with, first there was onions and then there was garlic. And I start exactly the same way my mother's did, but I don't grab for the oil first. I just grab for my good heavy pan.
Mm-hmm.
And it tastes exactly the same, except it doesn't have that oily flavor. And you end up eating so much more of the nutrients. We end up eating much larger portions.
Right.
I think, Lisa, right? Because, to keep the calorie intake. So you get to eat a lot more of the same delicious food.
More food.
And you mentioned easy, Karen, and I just want to clarify here that I am not a cook. at all by any stretch of the imagination. I am culinarily impaired, seriously. Cooking intimidates me, and Amy's recipes are so easy, and I'm making my way through all of them. They are delicious, and if I can make them, anyone can.
I'm really dating myself now, but I remember that commercial. I hate to cook, and I wrote the I Hate to Cook book. Who was that? And what commercial was that for? I don't know, but
I remember the book, but not the commercial.
Right. Okay. This oil thing, I don't want to labor it a little, but I think we agree. I believe in fats, and I believe fats are healthy in the diet, and I get mine from whole foods like raw nuts and seeds and avocado.
Same.
I know that there's this kind of undercurrent debate in the vegan world, oil, no oil, little oil, some oil, or
fats and
none. And
I think that the caveat is heart disease. If you're trying to reverse your heart disease the Dr. Esselstyn way, and my husband really does need to watch it as well, if you have heart disease and you are trying to reverse it, then you really do need to stay away from any of the added fats.
Well,
the nuts and the avocado.
Familiar with his work, and it's great. But
right.
Dr. Furman, who's another great plant-based doctor, will say that's not necessary. He really believes
in
raw nuts and seeds.
That's definitely a debate, but
choice.
Lisa and I do that.
Yeah. Right, but you can. There's a lot that's similar between them, and that's the important part. Plants, eating lots of whole, minimally processed plants, they're delicious and wonderful. And then, you know, if you want to split a few hairs and split a few nuts and figure that out, that's up to you.
Right. We make cashew creams a lot. I think Lisa and I both. Favorite thing to do.
Can we just go ode to cashew cream here for a moment?
Bow down to cashew cream, yes.
I usually buy, I'll go and buy a, you know, pound or two of raw cashews. They have to be raw at the time. Throw them in the Cuisinart, one part water to one part cashews, puree it, walk away for 8 minutes or so until it's smooth as silk. Then I just divide it up into little bags, throw it in the freezer. And last night I made a lackluster pasta sauce. And I really wanted something delicious and rich, and it just was boring because I didn't have anything good to put in. So I just grabbed the cashew cream. I defrosted it very, very quickly, threw it in, and my husband's like, this is the best thing you've ever made. I think like twice a week, cashew creams ends up in some meal that I'm doing. And then I feel like my kids are complete with their protein for the meal as well and their fats, especially having kids that are, you know, crazy, you know, high school athletes. Just I throw some marinara with some cashew cream in there, some whole grain pasta. Maybe some steamed broccoli on top. That's it.
Now, Amy, you have kids, and Lisa,
yeah,
do you have kids?
I don't have kids.
You don't. So just Amy, you've got teenage kids, and are they eating the way you and your husband are eating?
Okay, what the decision that I had made is that I will keep the home a certain way, and then out of the home they have their choice of what to do. So I don't tell them what to do out of the house. In the home, we keep it a certain way. I keep it vegan. Occasionally, you know, my kids will, you know, sneak in a little Parmesan here or there, but that's basically about it. So the home is vegan, and they enjoy it. And I have to be honest, as they get older, I'd be surprised if they all didn't eventually become vegan. They're becoming more and more vegan naturally on their own. But one's a vegetarian, and two, occasionally when they go out with their friends, they'll order something with a little chicken or meat in it, but they end up leaving it over, which is pretty hilarious. They think they're just accustomed to it. So I have a strict home, and whatever I pack lunch for them, which is quite often, and then every single dinner they have and every single breakfast they have. So the majority of their food, yes, is indeed, I get to control.
Great. And Lisa, your family, your siblings, and everyone around you, are they supportive of this diet?
Everyone is supportive. I have no converts, however.
Nope, not yet.
My mom keeps saying, I think I could be vegan except for the cheese.
Right. It's hard. And, you know, I think it's harder as we get older for lots of reasons, not just because of it's a behavioral thing, but when we've been doing something for so long and then we say what I've been doing hasn't been right, that's kind of tough.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's easier when we're a teenager and we're rebellious. We want to do something contrary.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, that's what I was all about when I was younger, and I don't want to say that I became vegetarian because I wanted to be contrary, but it was part of my nature. I was comfortable being contrary, so when I realized I didn't want to kill animals, it was easy. But I think it's a lot harder for adults because...
You know, and I think also their body, I think their body gets confused messages. I know my sister would say constantly, oh, you know, maybe it's that time in her cycle. And she'd be like, I crave iron. I need iron. I have to eat meat. But yet my body would never ask for meat. My body would just ask for more greens and spinach if I craved iron. So I just don't think the bodies are familiar with the messages that if you crave certain things, you're probably, you know, there's many other ways to get it.
That's a really interesting thing to talk about, cravings and how we misinterpret those feelings and those messages. We think we know what we need and we don't have a clue.
Chocolate for love? No, that's not what you're talking about.
No, but, you know, when we... lots of things go on in the body and we're learning more and more about it. And sometimes when we have addictions... And food can be an addiction. There are things that we crave because we're weaning ourselves off of them. Doesn't mean our body needs them, but we talk ourselves into thinking, oh, I'm craving it, so I need it. And we know, most of us know nothing about nutrition. We know a few words, protein. We have no idea what it is. We have no idea what a carbohydrate is or a complex carbohydrate. We have no idea what anything is, but we talk like, oh, I'm tired. I must need protein. No, you need to take a nap.
Well, I also think we get messages from the time we're children about what nutrition is. We take health classes. We have food pyramids. We hear from the milk board that we need dairy. We hear from the egg board we need eggs, all of that. And I find that a lot, that people come to me and say, well, milk is good for you. I have to have milk because where else am I going to get my calcium and vitamin D? So it's a matter of putting those myths to bed.
Okay. Wow. We just have a couple minutes. I can't believe it's already that fast. Wow. Okay. So, wow. Where can people find you and find this book? Do you have a website?
Our website is vegancheatsheet.com. We're on Amazon. We're in Barnes & Noble. We're in a lot of independent bookstores. We're in my local health food store.
And Amy, you have a business, and where are you?
My business, right now, it's distributed throughout a supermarket chain in Chicago and Cleveland called Heinen's. And probably, hopefully, in the next, you know, 6 months to a year, all goes well, we plan to be around the whole U.S.
Okay.
And it's called Vegan Eats.
Vegan Eats.
And veganeats.com is the website.
Okay, well, vegan is the word, and it's going to explode, and we're going to be there. Well, yes. Any last minute, do you have a favorite recipe you want to, we didn't Brent mention or before we go, or some last magic words?
We wrote the book because we wanted to show people how easy going vegan really is. So for anyone who thinks it's complicated, hard, or deprivational, pick up the book. We make it very easy, step by step. The recipes are fabulous. One of my favorite recipes is the curried butternut squash soup. Mm. What about you, Aime?
Oh, gosh. I honestly have to say the tomato rosa sauce with cashew cream. I make it probably twice a week. Mm. Some tomato sauce pureed with the cashew cream, shot of vodka when no one's looking, and everyone's happy.
That sounds great. Well,
one for the pot, one. No.
Hopefully we can all get together and share a meal sometime.
Yes.
That would be fun and delicious, I'm sure.
Yes.
Well, thanks for joining me on It's All About Food. I'm sorry we're at the end of the program, but here we are. Visit me at responsibleeatingandliving.com, and I do want to hear from you. I get really excited when I hear from some listeners, hear about their progress and their challenges. I just heard from somebody who had a third veganiversary. I'm so proud of you, Jim, for doing that. And have a delicious week.